So Bob emails, what do you say?
Yup.
Authentistic from Missouri. She says, I asked my newest therapist some questions to help me if we were a good fit. I had already expressed some doubts and uncertainties about her being a good fit. I told her I thought it would be good self-advocacy for me to request that she consult with her clinical supervisor about some of the issues she told me she wasn't familiar with regarding my issues. The response I got from her really triggered me emotionally, and so my memory is not very clear. But I do remember that I got the impression that she did not understand the concept of clinical supervision altogether. She actually said something like, I'm not sure if we do that at this clinic. I left the session feeling like I had done something wrong. Next session, I took a different approach, and I asked her if she would be willing to take some continuing education credits about the issues I'm seeking treatment for, because she's the only provider who I can find in my health coverage at this time who has any openings. But she is very experienced, and I just don't know the appropriate way to ask my therapist if they would be willing to seek outside expertise or continue their learning about issues their clients struggle with that they don't know about. This is really critical for me in finding a therapist who's willing to learn along with me, because I do not have access to more experienced providers who are more comfortable with educated clients like myself. Is it inappropriate to ask my therapist questions about their clinical supervision? Bob, what do you think?
Wow. I'm doing some reading between the lines here and making some guesses. So I'm speculating, say that. It would be, one thing you might do is you might ask them, what's the experience of me asking you to get the extra training, the additional training? It could be that they find that insulting, or they believe it's unnecessary. There's something important about it for you, though. I'm wondering what's important about that. And what I hear is you're not sure you're safe. You're not sure you're going to be treated properly. And maybe you're not, too. I don't know. But that seems to me like the cognitive level is, I want this person to be an expert. The emotional level is, I want to feel safe in therapy. Totally legit. Everybody ought to feel safe in therapy. You want to feel safe in therapy. I think you deserve to feel safe. The presumption is that if they don't get the training, you won't be safe. How do we know that? I mean, do we know that? I can understand why you would have that on your mind, but I don't know that you know that you will either not be safe or not get the kind of therapy you need. But it's hard to know, because if we don't know what kind of training that you're wanting that person to have, or what kind of supervision that you're wanting that person to have. I'm making guesses here. I wonder about what would be like, what's the potential here to explore, to develop a relationship here with, I can't believe I'm saying this, because that's what I'm about to say is going to take a long time, to develop a relationship with a therapist where part of what you do is you talk about your experience of therapy. It's also possible that maybe they're not a good fit for you. And I don't really know. Everything I'm saying here is just speculation about what my impression is of the thing. I'm not really comfortable.
Yeah. So authentistic from Missouri, what I would say is, your question is it appropriate to ask your therapist questions about their clinical supervision or wanting them to know things? And what I would say is, yes, it's absolutely fine to ask your therapist to seek outside knowledge. They don't have to do it, though, because you're not their boss and they might have time constraints or budget constraints or something, or it might be outside of their expertise or whatever. But you deserve to be able to ask, and you also deserve a satisfactory answer from her, whether she does it or not. She should be able to have empathy for you, to be curious about what you want her to know about, maybe to apologize, even if she decided she didn't want to seek any outside consultation or education, she could just say, look, I'm getting the message that there's some deficit in my, or at least you believe that there's a deficit in my knowledge, and that that's going to hinder my ability to help you. And I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry I don't have time to actually learn about these things. But whatever you want to tell me, I'm open. So I know that's not ideal, but I do care and I do want to know. So I'll do my best, just something like that. You don't have to, you don't have to go along with a client when they say do this, and you also don't have to shut them down, but there's an approach to it. So to review, you said, I want you to talk to your clinical supervisor, and then that didn't really work so well. You said that she said something like, I'm not sure if we actually do that at this clinic. You also said that your memory might not be very clear because you were triggered. And I don't know, but if I was to take a guess, and it's just a stab in the dark, that the therapist said that she doesn't have a supervisor because, you know, as you say, she's very experienced. And so, you know, typically, I mean, at an agency, sometimes you'll have a supervisor, but sometimes it's a very informal relationship. You know, like if I went back to an agency, I would have a supervisor that probably would have like 20 years less experience than me, you know, but they're in charge of my shift allocation and monitoring my paperwork and that kind of thing. But they're not, wouldn't necessarily be someone that would be overseeing my clinical development or my clinical work. They could be a consultant for sure, but so it's hard to say how that, why that conversation didn't go well. And then you said on the next session, I want you to take some continuing ed credits. And let's see, you didn't provide what her response was. Another factor here that you mentioned is that she's the only provider that you can find within your health coverage that has any openings. So you're kind of stuck with this person, even though it sounds like you would prefer to shop around a little bit, which sucks. And I'm sorry you're going through that. You know, if you're considering that this person isn't that great for you, you're in Missouri. I don't know where you are, if you're in a rural area or what, but you might consider shopping around a little bit longer if you don't feel like this person is good for you. You know, I realize that it might be hard, but finding a good fit, even if it takes a couple years to find a good fit, it's worth it, right? So even if someone doesn't have any openings now, but they will in 6 months, you know, maybe you stick with this therapist for a while and then you just plan on shopping around a little bit later. I might recommend that if you want to. But I'm going to provide an hypothesis, again, that's mostly shooting in the dark, which is that this is mostly a transference, counter-transference issue. Again, I don't have any data, hard data, to demonstrate this, but the last sentence that you said made me wonder if that's what's happening, and the lead-up to it. So, one, it's not like you said, hey, I don't like that you don't, that you didn't know this thing about me. Can we talk about that? It doesn't sound like that's what you said. It sounds like what you went to immediately was, I need you to talk with your clinical supervisor about the fact that you don't know what you're doing. I mean, that's not what you said, but it, you know, it's in that direction at least. And then the next session you said, I need you to take some continuing education credits. Again, it's like you're her boss or something. And now most therapists should be able to handle that and brush it off and be like, oh, okay, you know, and see what you're actually trying to say to them and respond therapeutically to it. But the last sentence you say, I do not have access to more experienced providers who are more comfortable with educated clients like me, is what you said. So again, if we were talking in person and I could hear your tone of voice, maybe it would all be interpreted differently by me. But this sounds like possible transference in that you might have grown up in it with an experience of being misunderstood, maybe even neglected. You know, did you feel like your parents took the time to really get to know you, or did they not? Were you neglected as a young child, causing you to develop some sort of tendencies of this sort of attitude, whatever I'm sort of detecting? This educated clients like myself, you know, superiority. It's just food for thought. I don't know, but maybe that would be something to talk about with your therapist. And if you are having that transference, which I would only give like a 1% chance that that's accurate, because I don't know, then you could be actually provoking a strong counter-transference reaction from your therapist that they're not dealing with very well, you know. But I don't know. But to answer your question, is there anything wrong with what you did? No. You know, clients can say these things all the time. And even if it is insulting, therapists are trained to be able to handle that, you know, and not take it personally, or to not at least retaliate on the client. And at the very least, you know, address it in a therapeutic way, like I was demonstrating earlier. And if that doesn't happen, then, you know, it's kind of a red flag, but who knows? Any thoughts on that, Bob?
No, everything you said is I really liked, and I particularly liked, you know, the speculation about what might be happening and the empathic response to that. Response to that.
All right, next email. Upper tier annual patron Kim from Arizona says, have you ever had a client who was too far gone for therapy to help in a meaningful way? Have you ever encountered a client who could not be helped by therapy? Bob, what do you think?
Have I ever encountered a client that could not be helped by therapy? It's impossible to know. It's possible that what the person needs is beyond my skill or my training or my experience or my ken or whatever it is. But it's also possible that nobody could help. It's impossible to say, though, and, you know, how are we defining the term help? I'm a big believer, you guys know, in the chip away thing. Like, we get to chip away at the things that are stuck inside us, but they are ours. So I have to say, I believe that there are some folks for whom we do not have adequate treatment for, and so therefore can't help. And I believe that there are many, many therapists who are not up to helping. Like, there's adequate therapy possibility, but the therapists themselves are not up to the task. But it's impossible to say this person or that person. And I would be reluctant to say that I met somebody who couldn't be helped, because the possibility that I can't help them just because I'm, you know, whatever my limitations are, exists. So, yeah, and I can't know.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. To me, my first knee-jerk answer is no. I've never met a client that I couldn't help in therapy. I've had clients that I couldn't help because they weren't in the right office. Like, if someone had psychosis, I'm not appropriate for that. I could certainly provide support for the difficulty of going through psychosis. I could help to build a team of people to be that initial provider that builds the psychiatry team and the family support team. And I've done that before, but I'm not going to be able to take away their bipolar. So I've had that before. But I think you're asking, Kim, are there clients that are just like too far gone, like their personality issue is too severe or something? And the answer to that is no. I've never ran into that. I've never thought that. I've had clients who were, severely traumatized. You know, you can imagine after 25 years, Bob and I have seen some severe cases, especially when you specialize in things like borderline personality disorder. And I've never once thought, oh, this person's too severe to be helped. I've never thought that. You go on, Kim, and say, can you be terminally traumatized? If so, what are the signs, and how do you handle such a client, especially after years of limited progress in therapy? Bob, what do you think?
I don't agree with the premise that a person can be terminally traumatized. I do think that we can be severely brain damaged by repeated trauma, particularly in childhood. But I don't believe in I don't even know what that term means. I think that everybody can have a life worth living. I'm not saying that everybody does or that everybody will. I sort of stand by what I said, which is therapy is a technology of change. And we don't necessarily have all the technology, and I don't really like that word, but we don't have all that's needed in order to help the human condition. So people continue to learn, they continue to develop new therapies, new ways of being. For the biologic stuff, they develop new drugs. And, you know, 150 years ago, if you had asked this question, we might have had a different response based on our knowledge level. And in 100 years, if you ask this question, we'll have a different response based on our knowledge level then. So I don't believe in this premise of terminally traumatized. And I do believe that seeking a life worth living is really all any of us can do. And so whoever you're referring to, I hope that they can seek a life worth living and find some peace, find something in being alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As far as I know, this is it. This is all we get.
Yeah, that's great. And I agree. The only thing I'll add to that is I think what Kim might be getting at is I've been in therapy a long time and I don't seem to be getting any better, or I'm not that much better. What's going on? And what I'll say is that I've worked with clients who there's this expectation that somehow it's like therapy is going to completely take things away, I guess. And I don't think that is ever the case. I've never met someone, well, I guess there are times when I'll have a discrete trauma condition and be able to treat that quickly. But the kinds of things like attachment issues, personality disorder traits, we're always just minimizing them and learning ways to make sure that they don't get triggered. They don't ever go away, really. So there's that. And I've worked with clients that were chronically traumatized growing up that had residual significant effects for the rest of their life, even though they're in a lot of therapy and they're doing a lot of good work. So I don't know if that's what you mean by terminally traumatized, Kim, but now I wouldn't say that you're doomed or there's no reason to try or life isn't worth living, like Bob says. I mean, one of the things that I think we need to accept is that everyone is terminally traumatized. If we sort of broaden the definition, everyone is permanently affected by the pros and the cons of their life, particularly their early life. So, and this notion that somehow you have the individuals with personality disorders and with attachment insecurity, and then there's the other people that everything's fine with, is ridiculous. Everyone I know has attachment insecurity. It's just whether or not it's to a level where we would call them avoidant or preoccupied or something. But in my world, I've never met anyone that I was like, that person I am confident as calling 100% secure. You know, I've never ran into someone that didn't have, you know, pretty sizable levels of preoccupation or avoidance or something. And so is that. But you ask Kim about signs of someone who has what I think you're getting at, which is someone that needs a lot of therapy and a lot of chipping away. And the signs of it for me, which I've seen many times, which is after, I would say, about maybe 3 or 4 years of good hard work in therapy, and I feel like we're doing a lot of good stuff, that we only see minimal symptom reduction. We see some symptom reduction, but not a lot. You know, they can be easily thrown back into old patterns. We can often feel like we're just running in place. And this is assuming that the person isn't having new traumas added that could complicate people and their traumas. But I've ran into that many times. And in the beginning of my career, I was very demoralized by it. But as I gained more experience, I learned through experience, even though people were probably telling me back then to have faith, I had to actually see it with my own two eyes. And what I learned was that if I just keep going 100% of the time, things do eventually get better. And there sometimes is a threshold that if I just sort of think anecdotally, maybe it's after 5 years, maybe it's after 8 years or something, maybe 3 years. There seems to be for some clients where it's like months and months and months. It doesn't seem to be getting better at all. And then all of a sudden I'll realize, oh, you know, things have been actually a lot better the past few months. And usually I'll point it out. You know, I'll say, you know, let's contrast how you're doing right now to how you were when I first met you. And even though things aren't great at times, but let's look at how far you've come and how different you are now and how you manage so much differently. Or if it's a couple, it's like how you're giving each other the benefit of the doubt. You know, your communication, your vulnerability is like so much higher. We have a long way to go, but it's so much higher before. You're saying things that I don't think you would have ever said for the first couple years I met you. Anonymous listener says, well, let's take a break first. What do you say, Bob? All right, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP. These people became patrons all the way back in June of 2020, Bob. All the way back then.
Wow.
We have Dell and Sabrina and Christina and Timothy and Gene and Dee and Annalisa and Ned and Layala and Stephanie and Georges. How do you pronounce this? Georges? Emily. So thank you for being patrons. I don't know where you're from because you didn't list that. But
I
have
that name, Sabrina.
Sabrina, yeah, that's
a good name.
Yeah, feels 80s to me for some reason. Wasn't there some sort of actress or some singer named Sabrina back then?
No, I want to look it up. Like, what's the meaning of the name?
We have Ingrid from New Jersey. We have Michelle from Missoula, Montana. You've been to beautiful Missoula, Montana.
I like Missoula. That's a great town.
Yeah. Chantel from Jacksonville, Florida. Tessa from good old Seattle. Andrea from Edmonton. Krabby from Elk Grove, California. Sandy Lee from Oakland. Catherine from Kingston, Jamaica? Oh, wow. Catherine from Kingston, Jamaica.
Wow.
That, right? Isn't Kingston JM? Isn't that Jamaica?
JM is Jamaica.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever had someone from Jamaica before be a patron. That's amazing. Kate from Bakersfield, California. Thank you so much for being a patron and staying a patron through thick and thin. Anonymous listener says, my therapist berated me during our session for 40 minutes, nearly yelling and labeling my objections as defenses and leaving me shaken and upset. I considered terminating. He later apologized via text. I'm wondering if there's a therapeutic value in this kind of counseling or if it is always wrong. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a mistake. Mismanagement of countertransference. It's up to you about what you want to do. There might be lemonade in the lemon and talking to the therapist about it and about the impact of their text apology.
Yeah. He apologized, which is a very good sign.
Yeah.
So I would say if you like the therapist, it's worth seeing if you can repair the rupture. But yeah, I mean, berating for 40 minutes and nearly yelling sounds pretty awful. You know, it's hard to know, though, because it could be some sort of distortion by the client, you know. But
yeah, we can't know.
But the key is that he's open to taking responsibility for at least something. And we know we get emails from people with their therapist where that is not the case.
Yeah, right.
So I deal a lot with this with my supervisees. And often when they're talking about their ruptures, it's all through the therapist's eyes. And how do I know that the supervisee is not distorted? I assume that they are to some extent. And so I'm not usually in a position of trying to figure out like who's right, who's wrong. I'm just like, well, there's a lot of work there. There's a lot of conversations and it doesn't really matter who's to blame here. You have to repair that rupture. And it doesn't mean you have to fall on a sword, but it means that you have to be humble and empathetic and listen and apologize for whatever you think is possible for you to apologize for. Even if the client you know was wrong about some things, you are the professional in that room and you have a responsibility. It doesn't matter. You know, as long as the client didn't try to hit you or threaten you or something, as I always tell my supervisees, clients come to therapy because they have problems. And so part of their problems might involve them being distorted towards you, having unjustified anger or rage towards you. Again, it doesn't mean you have to be abused or a victim or something. But, you know, like a common thing that I'll hear will be a client will be talking about, I don't know, their relationship or something. And they're just like, and they're clearly distorted, some sort of personality disorder, perceptual distortion. The client is like, yeah, well, so I came home from work. The house was a mess. You know, naturally, I was in a bad mood. My partner came to me and said, why are you in a bad mood? And I was just like, of course I'm in a bad mood because look at how bad the house is. And then my partner got upset and started yelling at me. And this is how my life goes. I mean, how ridiculous is my partner? You know, that kind of talk or something. And that's not far off the mark, honestly, of what a client might say. Then the therapist, you know, chronically deals with this and has anger and maybe issues of their own from their past that are being triggered by this client and starts to tell the client, like subtly or not so subtly, you're wrong. You're the one that's being unfair here. I mean, people don't have to clean the house for you. And even if the house was really dirty, like you don't have to emotionally punish everyone for it, you know. And then the client will give pushback and say, like, how dare you? You don't understand. My partner agreed to clean the house. Like, you're just biased against me or people like me or whatever. And in that situation, we can say, okay, well, the therapist is right and the client is wrong, you know, if we're reading it correctly. But so many therapists that I've trained, which is natural to do, but they get into this mindset of like, but I'm right. You know, I'm right. My client is wrong. It's obvious. And I'm like, what class did you take that taught you how to evaluate if you're right or wrong, one, and two, how to make sure other people understand that they're wrong? Like, which class was that? What book did you read? What chapter was, that involved a therapeutic technique about, or what mode of therapy involves making sure clients understand that they're wrong about things?
Carl Rogers, The Early Years.
Before the empathy. So I get it, because culturally that's what we're taught to do. We're taught to judge. We're taught to point out people are wrong. We're taught to shame people. I'm just going to throw this out there. It's not very therapeutic, i.e. it doesn't work. So I say, what's going on there? They're distorted. They have a perceptual problem. They're overreacting. Why are they doing that? And it's like, well, you know, he's just making a choice, essentially, is what they'll say. And I'll be like, okay, that's what you're taught. Again, what chapter did you read in graduate school that involved like clients making personal choices to have symptoms? You know, you didn't read that. So conceptualize, what's going on? Why do you think that's happening? Have an idea, have a hypothesis. Eventually it's like, well, he was traumatized a lot as a kid and has developed a lot of defenses and schemas that he sees things that aren't there and interprets things in that way. And then he's off to the races because he initially is triggered and then it feels justified to him, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I'm like, okay, so given that, how do you feel about your treatment plan and your behavior as a therapist in sessions? It's like, well, okay, I didn't do a good job because I was just basically falling into a projective identification seduction of being like his parents and judging him. Okay, so how can you not be that way? And they'll say, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, just let the client be that way with their partner? I mean, that's not fair. And I'm like, uh-huh. Okay, you're not letting them do that. You know, they'll do it whether you tell them not to or not. You know, you don't have control over them. So what's going to work to stop him from doing that for his sake and everyone around him's sake is that you actually provide therapy for him. Like, that's the work, you know. I'm saying this in a condescending way, and I'll admit that with some of my supervisees, I'll have this attitude eventually because I'll have a good enough relationship with them that I really want to kind of drive it home. And part of my anger around this and frustration is that, not with my supervisees at all, because they always absolutely go along with this and I think appreciate it, at least, you know, verbally they say so. I don't know if they actually do on the inside, but I will hear accounts from so many clients that will tell me about therapists who have this kind of attitude towards them, you know, like you and I know and will lament and get angry about the known phenomenon of people with borderline personality disorder being rejected as clients because their issues are too severe or something. People saying that, you know, you can't treat people with borderline. And I'm just like, so let me get this straight. You got into this business to only treat people with easy problems that make you feel like a good therapist at the end of the day. And as soon as something gets a little tough, then you're just like, nah, you know, it's like a pilot running into a storm and jumping out of the plane with a parachute. It's like, yeah, I didn't get into this job for this kind of thing. This is too hard for me. It's like, why did you become a therapist? Now, you know, people can have different directions for their careers, but I don't know. Am I wrong, Bob? Am I being too judgy right now?
No, not at all. Of course, I'm thinking, if I'm the pilot who jumps out of the plane and I'm saying, see, that storm's, that it, you can't do nothing about the weather, right? But that's not how it is with people. So that attitude that therapists will take that so-and-so is not treatable. Like we just talked about this a minute ago. It can't be known. It can't be known. They used to say that very commonly for borderline personality disorder, even, well, they probably still say it, but 20 years ago. One of my first clients who had borderline personality disorder, when we met, she had like, what, 8 of the 9 criteria. And by the time we were done together, which was, I don't know, maybe 20 months, maybe a little longer, she had 4. And that was a source of great pride for her and me.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that when therapists say, this isn't treatable or so-and-so is not treatable, what they're really saying is, I need a rationale to pass the buck and get out of this. They feel right. Guilty or ashamed or something.
Let's take a break, Bob, and answer another email.
Let's take a break.
All right, we're back from the break. So, you know, I had my monthly rant about that topic that I always rant about. So we can scratch that off the list. The next rant on the agenda is something about climate change. And so I'll make sure I get to that at some point in the next couple of months. Long-term patron Scott says, can you discuss what it means to not cavort with a client and how to build and maintain an alliance with a client while not cavorting and challenging the client? Bob, what do you think?
I don't know what that word means. Do you know what that word means?
Yeah. I was wondering if you would know. So I have, what comes to mind when you don't Google it. What comes to mind when you think cavorting?
I think of going out for drinks.
Yeah. That's, you know, what, or like, I think flirting is what, flirting. Line.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
I looked it up and it means, it has two kind of related definitions. One is to leap or dance about in a lively manner, as in the otters cavorted in the stream. The next definition is to engage in extravagant behavior. And they give an example. The governor has been criticized for cavorting with celebrities. So I think that's what Scott is talking about. That can you discuss what it means to not cavort with a client, meaning don't hang out, like you were saying, like have a drink with them and party with them or something. But I still don't really understand the question, because it's like, how do you build and maintain an alliance with a client with while not cavorting and challenging the client? And then it's, and there's that word, the challenging, like how does that relate to cavorting? Shouldn't that, I don't understand. What do you have any idea what Scott's getting at here?
We might not do Scott's question justice, since neither one of us really understands what he's asking. But maybe he's saying, how do you thread the needle between having a good alliance and having it be bounded, you know, like in the office? So I you know, the beginning and end of my connection to my clients starts and ends with their hour. And I don't hang out in between. Might exchange the occasional text message here and there, but you know, we see each other, and I am actively providing therapy in that time, and otherwise don't generally see them. So in that time, I act with an attitude of care and interest and curiosity, and that to me is what's needed to build an alliance. And there isn't any cavorting involved in that, as I understand it.
Yeah. I don't have much more to say to that other than, technically speaking, the alliance is goals, tasks, and bond. In terms of not being friendly with a client or not cavorting, if I understand what you mean by that, I can certainly build, you know, a consensus of goals and tasks to meet those goals. Bond, though, obviously is very complicated, and Bob basically talked about that. And I can be very human and interested and have a lot of empathy. I can be very disciplined regarding making sure that distractions aren't around. And that's particularly important now with the pandemic, with so much distance therapy happening. You know, it's so easy for both client and therapist to get distracted by things.
Really?
By the way, yeah. I mean, well, you do video therapy, right?
I do. Yeah.
So that's harder to become distracted, but I don't do video. I do phone. So on my end, what I do, and it's pretty easy for me to keep distractions to a minimum, is I stay in my office. You know, I don't roam around.
Right.
I also I pace. So Do you pace when you talk on the phone?
Yeah, sometimes. I've had a couple of phone sessions, and I might pace or I might play with something with my hands just as a way to occupy my body and help me focus and pay attention. It's interesting that I might do that on the phone, but not in a video chat.
Right. Yeah, I would never do it on a video chat, but when I'm on the phone, and I've always done this, I literally walk in circles in my office.
Yeah.
I just walk in a
roomy.
I just walk in a circle. I just...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an obstacle course because the section by the window, there's some things I kind of have to avoid. Yeah, I just, you know, I've always done that. Talking to clients or anyone, I've always just paced. It's weird. But I've heard other people do that. I've heard other people will pace when they talk on the phone.
Yeah.
And I make sure that the dogs and Stacy know that I'm in session so they don't make any noise or this kind of thing. But on the client side, I can't always know because they can call me from wherever they want to call me from. And sometimes they actually don't want to be home because their family's there. So they'll leave and they'll go on a walk.
Yeah.
And I'll hear like trucks and airplanes and people and dogs. And there's a lot of opportunity for distraction. And so sometimes it's kind of hard. But at least on my end, I could, build a bond by not being distracted and all those kinds of things. But yeah. So, Scott, I don't know if we answered your question. And normally I would just sort of blow right past it. But you're a long-term patron. You've been around a while. So I want to make sure that, we answer. So, feel free to email in. All right. Some fun questions, Bob.
All right.
This is in reference to our talk about Frasier and Maris and Niles.
Right. I remember that. Right. Was Niles cheating on Maris? Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So before I give this comment, I want to say that this person commented on Spreaker. So a little bit on the weeds of this is we post our podcast, our audio podcast episodes on this website called Spreaker, and then Spreaker populates it on iTunes and Spotify and iHeartRadio and your podcast app, and Spreaker puts it on everywhere else. And actually Spreaker also is they're the people who put the ads in. So so this person had commented on Spreaker and I'm like, why are you listening? So, because no one knows about Spreaker. It's not like Spotify or iTunes or something. So I just thought it was bizarre. I'm sure, Bob, you're confused by this whole thing, but
I don't really get it.
To me, it was a very strange notification to get that someone had commented on Spreaker, because I didn't even know anyone knew to go there. You know what I mean? So anyway, and I was surprised.
Maybe Spreaker
I even
also huh? Is it its own platform as well?
It is, but no one uses it that, or at least I don't know of anyone that uses it as like their go-to place to listen to our podcast anyway. But anyway, so this is this person commenting, and I don't know who it was because I don't think Spreaker keeps track of the name. So anyway, it says, Kirk isn't correct about Maris. Maris, because I was saying that Maris was being treated unfairly by Niles because Niles was having this emotional affair, and that's not cool. But this person says, Kirk isn't correct about Maris. Maris was emotionally abusive and withholding. She wasn't a nag. She was cruel, neglectful, and self-centered. Niles wasn't the problem. Maybe what he did wasn't right in terms of emotionally cheating, but he tried his best to make a very hurtful person happy while also finding a woman that makes him happy, though putting himself in denial about it. End of comment. The thing that I'll say about this is I can see this person's point of view, honestly. I haven't watched Frasier in 20 years, so I had completely forgotten the whole Niles Maris storyline. And when I saw this comment, I was like, oh yeah, I guess it is true. Like, Maris wasn't just this distant character that Niles felt distant from. Maris was actually mean to him. And that was the joke, right? That she was abusive and he was weak, I guess, was the joke, which is not very pleasant to think about in terms of, like, if we reverse the genders, right? If a woman was had this off-screen husband that was being emotionally abusive. Like, that's not funny, but somehow with men victims, it's funny. It's not funny at all.
Yes, my read on that email is that because Maris's behavior sucked too, there's no way Niles could be accused of betraying her. And I think that's completely false.
Yeah, right.
The presumption that the person who's on the end who gets betrayed is some lily white, non corrosive, whatever victim. You know, in real world, if a marriage is in distress, it's because something's happening for each person, not just one.
Yeah, two wrongs don't make a right, essentially. Right. I mean, there is something about this comment, though, that I don't remember, and maybe you do, is they're saying that Niles was in denial about his... So I think what they're saying is, at least for a series of episodes, Niles was having feelings for... What's her name? The housekeeper.
Right? Daphne, yeah.
Daphne. And... but was really struggling internally with it because it just seems so off the table. And he was dealing with this, you know, maybe somewhat abusive wife. And one could have sympathy for that because he didn't have a lot of space or time to think, am I actually cheating right now? Or what do I want? Or how do I feel? Like he was just kind of trapped in this survivor mode or something. And then maybe eventually he started to figure out, oh, I maybe I shouldn't. Is that maybe what happened? Could that maybe be more sympathy for Niles?
Oh, I think you can have sympathy for Niles, but let's be clear: this show is a sitcom, so it's gonna portray things in a way that makes people laugh. So Niles isn't in denial of his attraction. Frasier and the dad keep discouraging it. So every time he stares at her, Frasier will turn his head or something like that, right? He's definitely discreetly, but absolutely fascinated by her.
Yeah.
Okay. Discreet. Actually, he's not discreet at all. She just doesn't see it.
Right.
But everybody else does.
Patron Maria from Washington says, I have a fun question. I came over for a wedding near Bremerton at Scenic Beach State Park. Have you been there, Bob? Scenic
no,
Beach
I don't State think so. Park. No.
Yeah. I spent one day in West Seattle hanging out on Alki and ate at Marination for the first time. Have you ever been there? Also, what's your favorite way to spend a day on a sunny day in Seattle? So, Bob, have you been to Marination on Alki?
No. What's that?
It is a Hawaiian-Korean food, fun atmosphere place. It's new. I don't know when it started, but and it's on the side with, is it Salty's or what's that restaurant there?
Oh, yeah. Salty's, yeah.
It's not on the main business side. It's on the Seattle downtown side, you know. And... No, I haven't been there, but I love Hawaiian and Korean food, particularly Hawaiian food. So if you don't know, as a Japanese American, Hawaiian food, 90% of it is Japanese American food. Now, people in Hawaii might argue that there's a lot of infusion of Filipino and Chinese, and there certainly is, and also Native Hawaiian, you know, like taro root and saimin, which is, I believe, a Chinese noodle dish. I mean, you know, deriving from China. But with the spam musubi and loco moco and all those kinds of things are, at the very least, that's what I grew up on. All the food that you serve in a Hawaiian restaurant was literally the food that my grandma made for my dad. And when my mom and dad got married when they were 19 and my mom didn't really have any preferences, my dad basically dictated what sort of food was going to be the routine in our household, and it was all Japanese American stuff. And so Hawaiian food to me is just like, I don't know, it's I can't even tell you how much I love it.
Yeah, turkey like
yeah, which makes me think I should get some. I wonder if Grubhub actually has. And of course, you know, because I talked about this in a previous episode, that there's a chance that I have COVID right now, because there's a pretty good chance that my wife has it. And I am just now realized, because we just realized really today that it's real, that she has it. I mean, she hasn't tested positive for it yet, but in all likelihood, she has it. And there's a chance that I have it, or at the very least, you know, I don't want to spread it. So I can't go to
a
restaurant.
You're quarantined.
Yeah, I'm quarantined, right? And I think
blocks.
I think, of course, that's obvious, but I just sort of realized that in my head, that I can't go to I can't go to a Hawaiian restaurant. I have to do Grubhub. I can't go to the grocery store.
Right.
Because this is the first time that's really happened to me, I think. Anyway, have you had Hawaiian food, Bob?
I don't think so. We went to Hawaii once, but I don't know if we had Hawaiian food.
You went to Hawaii once, and you don't know if you had Hawaiian food.
Yeah.
Have you had Spam of any kind in your life?
Not in Hawaii. At home, yeah, when I was a kid.
Okay, like Spam and eggs, that kind of thing?
Yeah, okay. that kind of thing.
That's a very Japanese-Hawaiian thing, a Japanese-American.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, Spam and eggs. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know
Well,
that.
Because...
Sunday breakfast at my house.
I'm only 80% sure of this. I mean, not that Japanese-Americans and Hawaiians invented that, but the reason why it's soul food to us is because, and I'm only 80% sure of this, is that during World War II, during the internment, we were given army rations in prison because that was readily available. And Spam was originally an army ration, which makes total sense, right? It's canned protein, right?
Right.
And to some extent, disgusting, you know? And so, I mean, that congealed fat or whatever that's around the whole...
Yeah.
I feel like they've managed to reduce that significantly. But when I was a kid, you know, that gel was pretty significant when you took it out. But, and so the Japanese Americans just made do and made it into sushi and made it into all sorts of dishes, teriyaki, this kind of thing. And so... So, yeah.
I could see teriyaki be good. Cut the salt some.
Yeah.
Because Spam's pretty salty.
Yeah. You can get reduced salt Spam, which is good. Yeah, they have all sorts of different... They have reduced salt. You know, anyway. But Maria asked another question. What's your favorite way to spend a day on a sunny day in Seattle? Which we've had almost none of this summer. But... What's your favorite way, Bob?
These days, it's tinkering in the garage. So right now I'm rehabbing a very old tool chest and improving it. So that's what I do. I go out in the garage and I strip metal drawers of paint and repaint them and build a toolbox-y kind of thing to hang my electric tools and stuff like that. I really like spending time out there.
What about like an outing? What's
an outing? Oh. Well, these days we'll go up to the Ridgecrest and get a drink. They have good wine, beer selection.
Yeah.
So these days we go up there. We went up there and we went. Oh no, we didn't. I was thinking we went for a drink and then we went to a movie, but we didn't. We didn't actually go for a drink. We just went to the movie. We're not very adventurous here at my house.
No, no, that's a wonderful. That's me and Stacy.
Oh, yeah,
as well.
You know that pub.
Yeah, I think I would like to get takeout sandwiches and tater tots and go to Carkeek Park.
Oh, that's nice.
Sit on a park bench and do that. I don't like that answer. I've done that before, but I don't know if that really feels like...
Guess that's what we're getting from you today, though.
Yeah. Okay. Last question, Bob. Anonymous patron, annual patron Soft Noodles. She says, question for Bob about his book. When I was around the age of 7, I had this fantasy about there being this machine where you could put these plasters on your head and on another person's head, and it would give you the ability to read the other person's mind and feel their feelings.
Ah.
I would fantasize about giving the machine to people around me, like my parents, so they could maybe finally understand me.
Mm.
Later, as an adult, I often fantasized how great it would be if my therapist had this device. I even wrote a mini essay about it called The Translator that I never finished.
Oh, I like that title.
Let's just say that when you guys described Bob's book, my mouth dropped to the floor a little bit, as I feel like I have been thinking about this concept my entire life as my own private little fantasy.
Right on.
I relate a lot to Bob, and it made me wonder if there is something about our similar trauma history that makes this idea appear in one's brain. I really hope you finish your book, Bob. I think reading it would feel really personal and interesting to me. Funnily enough, you describing the plot kind of felt like you were taking a little peek into my mind. P.S. as a creative person, I know the terror of what if someone else just comes up with the exact same idea. So I hope this doesn't make you feel that. Personally, I like this concept. I think this concept couldn't be in better hands than yours, Bob. What do you think?
Well, that's just so kind. Thank you. That's an interesting theory. Is there something about our similar natures that would make this kind of idea or this kind of concept appeal? I think for me, it's the desire and fear about being known, I think, is why mind reading it became central. It wasn't what I set out to write about, but it's just sort of evolved that way. My subconscious talking, I suppose. So to me, it's the push-pull desire to be, the push and pull of the desire to be known fully.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, could you see people with that frustration having greater likelihood of having that fantasy?
Yeah, I could. I could see people with yeah, yeah.
Do you think you might have had a seed of this when you were young in some metaphorical sense? Like, well, the way that Soft Noodles, since the age of 7, has been thinking about this, you know?
Right. I can't say that I recognize that, though I do remember an episode of Star Trek back in the day which had an empath in it, and what she could do was absorb the pain of the other. And so if somebody got wounded, she could take on their wound and they would be instantly healed and she would have to survive the wounding. And she was really ambivalent about her ability to do that. So that's been with me forever, you know, since I was little, watching Star Trek reruns.
Did that resonate with you somehow as a kid?
Resonate in the way that I could relate to it personally, like some kind of deep way? No, I just thought it was really interesting. I really believe that the mind reading part of my story is about ambivalence, about being connected, because it's choiceless at that point. Somebody can look inside your noodle and see who you are, see how you feel, see the world from your point of view. You don't get a choice in sharing it. It's just what's available to them. And in some ways that would be really exciting, because then Colleen could know me, say, you know, like fully. The whole of me. And perhaps it's about the existential dilemma around autonomy and wish for connection. Because on the other hand, that scared the hell out of me. So
that's interesting. I hadn't thought that. I didn't think that it was about ambivalence, but of course, that's what you kind of talked about in terms of the process, right? There's pros, you know, there's a pro to having that ability, but different from Soft Noodle's device, you can't take it off. So yeah. once it's in there, it's you got to deal with the fact that you're now going to absorb other people's thoughts and feelings, whether
yeah,
you want to
juicy.
Or not.
Oh, yum 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 yum.
Well, and I don't know if this is what really gets you in terms of your traumas and attachment, is that the push-pull or the ambivalence of attachment for the disorganized individual.
Mm-hmm.
Because on one hand, it's like a deep, deep desire to mm-hmm. finally be understood and seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's absolutely not. It's dangerous. There's a lot of, terror and danger mm-hmm. and threat to that. Uncomfortableness with being approached,
right,
and seen, because of it could go badly, and two,
right,
the inherent unfortunate conclusion and distortion that there's something deeply wrong with me, and that's why
right.
people are avoiding. So if people came
right.
into my head, well, surely they would finally see that I'm a horrific human being and
right.
and out me or confirm my deepest fears that I am a horrible human being.
I've been thinking lately that it's disappointment is far more attractive than terror. So disappointment in being unknown feels a lot safer and more accommodated than the risk of actually being seen and known. Mm. Which is really cool, because sometimes people can feel really frustrated about, oh, you know, God damn it, the world doesn't know me, or so-and-so doesn't really get me, and be blind to the fact that actually, given the opportunity, it would probably be, at least for people like me, absolutely terrifying to be that exposed.
Yeah. And in your book, it's like kind of forced.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of what makes it interesting.
Yeah. And so the book is an expression of that feeling for you?
Well, I never thought about it that way before, but yeah, clearly it is.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, actually, it's funny that this came up, because in my writing group, we've been talking for almost 2 years now about, well, what the hell is it? And does it have to be in the story? Because maybe this could be an interesting story about a young man and an old man engaged in therapy with one another. And I just couldn't let it go. I was just like, yeah, maybe it doesn't belong, but I...
Or are they suggesting their opinion is that it's extraneous?
Well, that's the running question is like, well, what is it? Because
is it just a question to them, or do they think that possibly?
No. Well, sort of. What my teacher says is everything that you write belongs in the book, maybe in the form that it is, or maybe in the meaning that it's meant to convey. And so what you want to do is you want to keep everything, but you want to distill it to its actual meaning. And so what I was thinking isn't, does mind reading belong in the book? What I was thinking is, what does it mean to be able to mind read? And I think Soft Noodle's question is helping me actually clarify that.
Yeah. I mean, you know a billion times more than I do about these sorts of things. But yeah. I would say, just vibe-wise, my impression of what I do know and have read of your book, that element is critical. Even if it doesn't have a meaning, I think it's, I don't know, it just adds a certain... It's like how all the Marvel movies, you know, that
yeah.
Do we need Thor to fly and have a hammer? No, we don't need him. It's more about the hero's journey or companionship or having despair and grief over your brother dying or, I don't know, something, depression. Yeah. So you don't need that element, but I think it absolutely relates to the emotional push of the story.
Right.
And I think that's why we love sci-fi. That's why we love superhero movies, because
oh yeah,
when you add this little twist of the supernatural, I don't know. You would know better how to describe it, but to me, it just adds a level of interest or intensity, or
yeah,
because it's a metaphor, right?
Right.
You know, when Iron Man's heart is weak and he has this device in that's keeping him alive and
right
one
strengthening his heart or protecting it.
Yeah, yeah. One wrong move and he's at death's door and he's
right.
It touches, that would never happen in our lifetime.
No.
But it touches something in us emotionally. It goes straight for it.
Right.
In a way that if you tried to evoke that emotion without those kind of elements, there's obviously ways you can do it, but
right.
I don't know, maybe the way that I think about it, it's almost like it comes in through the back door, because you're following the technical side of it, I guess, like with your story.
Right.
But the way it feels in your heart is some unknown, almost like feelings you can't articulate about the desire or the invasiveness of being in other people's minds, right?
Well, that's what every storyteller wants, is for the elements of their story to be in the thing so naturally that the audience doesn't know that they're that it could only be this way, that what happens makes all the sense in the universe and it couldn't be any other way. So I think the hammer that Thor carries is about goodness, because only those who are worthy can pick it up. So that's just him. Now, I always have a problem with him because, you know, in many ways, he can be a real jerk face. But for whatever reason, he's worthy of the hammer. And that was my favorite part of the last bit of that last movie, you know, where the hammer starts floating and you see Captain America and he's holding it. I was like, I always love that scene. It's like, oh, he's worthy, right? And he's a really good guy, you know, so you can kind of see that that's the case. And then the Hulk, that's about disowned anger, right? Or disowned rage, really. And then, you know, you could probably find something. Well, you most certainly could find something in all of them. Some kind of meaning in the superpower that they have that's beyond the actual literal power itself. Mm-hmm. So to embed that movie, When Harry Met Sally, is like, it's really good movie. Every element of story is in there in such a way that you don't even think about it. It's just, of course, this is what happens. Of course, it unfolds this way. It could only unfold this way. And yet, whoever wrote that, they struggled around writing it. Like, oh, what happens now? What part of the story am I in right now, or whatever? And yet, to us on this end of it, or Shawshank Redemption, it's absolutely seamless. It's just beginning, middle, end, and we're along for the ride. And Stephen King, at least back in the day, was a really great prose writer. I really like Stephen King's older stuff, the newer stuff, not so much. But I never read the horror stuff. I'm sure that's scary as shit, but it's not my bag, horror. But I love that book, and he's written some others that are similar to it. And but that story just unfolds beginning to end, and you are just along for a really great ride. And every element of story is there, just so seamless that you don't even notice.
Mm-hmm.
Really great. I mean, some of them are just fantastic.
Yeah, it's really incredible to witness that good storytelling. And ugh. And when you watch a bad movie, you're just like, how come you didn't hire a good writer? Or why did you ignore the writers? Like,
oh my god,
like there's
so bad.
There's like, it's hard to write a really good story, but it's not hard to write at least one that makes sense or has a satisfying arc to it. You know, like there are Simpsons episodes that have perfect arcs to it, right?
Right.
Or even like children's shows, like Sesame Absolutely. Street probably has a segment with a perfect arc to it, and it's simple. It's made for 4-year-olds. And so it's just like some people's writing, like episode 9, Star Wars. It's just like, so what's the arc here? Like, so stupid. Anyway, and the just while I'm on that topic, the way that J.J. Abrams and the other writer, the way they described how they wrote it, this is how they described it.
Yeah.
You can appreciate this because I'm, you know, writers always have some kind of method of mapping out their story. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And there's the hero's journey and, you know, there's all that kind of stuff. And
right.
The way that they wrote the story, and it totally reflects in episode 9, Star Wars, is they sat the two of them around a table and brainstormed different moments that they wanted in the mm-hmm. movie,
mm-hmm.
different scenes, different beats that they wanted,
mm-hmm.
totally unrelated to each other,
mm.
and wrote them down on post-it notes and then put them up on the wall. And then once they had a bunch on the wall, they started organizing them. And that's exactly how that movie comes across, because
it's like a patchwork quilt.
And I can tell you what was on that stupid ass patchwork quilt. One was, I want to see Rey and Kylo kiss, which is ridiculous. Another one mm-hmm. is, I want Chewbacca to get his medal. Another one is, I want, I want Kylo and Han Solo to have a scene together. Another one is, I want Leia and Ray to have, you know, it, like, there's these stupid little disconjointed
plot points. Don't write there's from no plot.
There's no hero's arc. There's no journey. There's no sense to it. They introduce new characters along the way, which should never be done in a sequel of a sequel. Like, there's so much to wrap up and so many characters anyway. And so, yeah, it was just so bad. But anyway, another thing about this is that Shawshank Redemption, I loved when I was younger. I rewatched it, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I did not like it that much as an adult.
Really?
As an older adult.
Why not?
I don't remember. I just remember thinking, like, it's a perfectly serviceable movie. Like, there's some, particularly in the beginning, I think it has some really great scenes. Like, when they're on the roof and he gets the beer for everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, there's these things where you've never seen a story beat like that before. Like, it's such a unique little, but you can really feel the humanness. Mm-hmm. And it also almost feels like of that time or something. And it really connects you with the main character played by, what's his face?
Tim Robbins.
And
Morgan Freeman, yeah.
And you can you can feel the joy in that hot sun after you're slopping all the tar around, and you just get a cold beer for the first time in how many months, you know?
Right.
So there's little scenes like that that are great, but a lot of it just felt towards the end like, I don't know, cheesy is what comes to mind. Wow. I know that's sacrilegious to say, and I used to believe...
No, it's fine. It's your...
In my early 20s, I would have put that in my top five movies of all time. And I'm not saying that I was dumb back then. I'm just saying that there was a time when it really resonated with me. And the other movie you mentioned was...
When Harry Met Sally.
When Harry Met Sally. I never really liked that movie. I mean, I've always thought it was fine. Yeah. In fact, the story was the thing that always kind of got me, because I didn't really understand the motivation of her character at the end. Because, you know, I'm trying to remember, like, what happens, you know, it's a spoiler movie that's 35 years old, but, you know, they're friends and they know each other, but they have kind of an attraction, but they're also kind of, they're argumentative. They're both sort of alphas, if you will. Like, neither one of them backs down. And they, at the very end, he runs to her, right? Like,
yeah, that's right.
Similar to
New York, because it's New Year's Eve.
Similar to like Pretty in Pink. It sort of reminded me of the ending of Pretty in Pink. But, and also there's just something about her acting that's always sort of, sometimes it's cute, and other times I'm just like, it seems a little cartoony or something.
You get distracted by Meg Ryan, the actor.
Yeah, Billy Crystal is great in it. And, of course, the soundtrack I listened to a billion times, Harry Connick.
Right.
But, yeah. So, you know, I know I'm kind of being a dick to say that, but...
No, that's all right.
Just
sister taste.
I feel like I... Yeah.
Oh, shit. I bumped the mic.
It's okay. You don't have to say that every time.
I hereby confess my sin.
The last thing I'll say is regarding the mind reading thing. For me, when I think about that, I only think I would like that, and it makes me wonder. In contrast to the vibe that you have about it, it makes me wonder why that is. And I think what it shows is, one, I don't have disorganized attachment. I wasn't abused, and thus I don't feel threat of, and I don't also have a schema that there's something deeply wrong with me, you know, the way you were taught. So there's no threat to people knowing what's in my soul and having full access to my entire being. Like, I don't have, I mean, I wouldn't be super comfortable with that. There'd be like some caveats to, like, well, when you find this in my soul, let me give you a little bit of context, or, you know, but I wouldn't be worried that they would hate me or something, you know, not that they would love it, but I don't know. It just wouldn't feel threatening.
Right.
And I am attracted to that because I have, you know, some, you know, mild, but there, insecure attachment that will either manifest as avoidance or preoccupied.
Mm-hmm.
Usually avoidance, but sometimes preoccupied. But the underlying foundation is the same, which is a loss of closeness and a desire for it, you know. And sometimes I do wish that people could just know me and mm-hmm. I could know them and I wouldn't feel that distance. So to me, when I think about the a chip being in, you know, forced in my head or whatever the mechanism is, I'm like, let's go for it. You know, it's only a plus. Yeah. now that could be naive, right? Like if it was real, maybe it would be pretty awful. I don't know. But sometimes I get pretty frustrated with being misunderstood or not understanding other people. And we all just sort of, you know, fall into our routines and misunderstand each other. And
sure.
I just wish that there was some way to really understand other people, like, immediately, you know, the full vibe, just like, boom, I get it. I don't even need to see their facial expression. You know, I get it. And them, me, I think I've wanted that my whole life. So, you know, I could relate to the two of you, at least on that level, you and Soft.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, Bob. So that does it for that episode.
Right on.
And if you have other fun questions, by the way, like this, like, you know, marination and Maris, it's much easier to get to those because they're just so much shorter. but anyway, so if you want Bob and I to answer a question, you want to go to the website, click on the contact button, fill out the form. Try to keep it short, by the way, you know, like maybe even edit it, because if it's super long, one, it's hard, and two, sometimes I won't even bother because I feel bad, but literally I don't have the time. I mean, some people will write like mm-hmm. pages and pages, and
mm-hmm.
I used to actually read those. I wasn't always super enthusiastic about it, and know that if I want more info, I will email you, which I'll do mm-hmm. sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now most of you are totally fine, but occasionally some people, and as long as everyone's fine with me never getting to those emails, you know what I mean? If someone just wants to vent and there's like, I got to tell this guy the whole story, like, you know, go for it. But I feel bad if I never get to it because it would literally take me 45 minutes to go through your email and kind of figure out what the gist of it is and maybe edit it down so that it can fit into a podcast episode. So, you know, just know that. But anyway, if you have and it always helps Stacy to be able to put it in the right folder if you say, hey, Kirk and Bob, it's somewhere mm-hmm. at the top, because then Stacy immediately knows, oh, this is, you know. So,
yeah.
And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.